Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ Dhammaṃ Sanghaṃ Namassāmi. So for the final reading of the retreat, I'll read a couple excerpts from talks from Lungpa Sumedho. The first talk is titled A Matter of Life and Death, and then it naturally goes into Towards the Future. For those who practice the Dhamma, life is a time for contemplation and reflection on the way things are. Even the death of our loved ones is part of our contemplation. We recognize that having been born means that we're going to separate from each other, that we'll see the death of those we know, and that we'll all die eventually. So this involvement with life and death is Dhamma for us. It's the way things are. There's nothing wrong with it. Our society refuses to accept and really contemplate death. We're so involved with life and trying to make everything nice during our lifetime that we tend to ignore the finale of life. So we're totally unequipped for it. If you think of what the most important events in a human life are, you realize they are birth and death. Well, the idea of birth, of having babies, is dear to the hearts of people, but the idea of death is baffling. What happens when somebody dies? What does it mean? The very perception of death leaves us in a state of not knowing exactly what's happened. What happened to that person we once perceived as being alive? Where did he go? Did he go anywhere, or is death just oblivion? Heaven, hell, oblivion, does anybody know? What we can know is that we don't know. We can know that we're still alive and we haven't died yet, and we can know that we don't know what happens when somebody dies. Now this may not seem like a lot, but it is very important, because most people fail to understand that they don't know. Instead, some people will believe anything, they'll settle for anything, any kind of speculation or creepy idea. The way of meditation is the way to die before your body dies. It's a way of dying before death and dying to death, so that, poetically speaking, death is dead, rather than anything else. By death, I'm talking about that perception in the mind. If the perception of death is taken personally, then we become frightened because we think we're going to die. Our perception of being alive is based on the view that this body is mine and that I am this body, so the perception of death is frightening. We live in a world of anxiety and fear over the death of our bodies, separation from what we love, or the mystery of what happens when we die. We wonder, is it worth being good, following moral precepts, and being kind? Or should we not be bothered because it doesn't matter? Is this universe without any moral principles so that you can murder and steal and lie and cheat because it doesn't really matter? After death, it's just oblivion. Or do our actions in this human form affect what happens next? Well, we could speculate about these questions for the rest of our lives. However, the Buddha pointed not to any speculation about life and death, but to the way things are in our living experience. And this is what meditation is about. It's an investigation, an examination, a profound looking into the way things are. We examine what the body is, what our feelings are, and what makes us feel joy and serenity. We see for ourselves what desire and attachment really are, and we watch conditions arise and cease. Dying before death is allowing that which has arisen to cease. This teaching is about the mind. We'll let the body die when it comes time for it to die. If it lives another minute, or another 50 years, or another 80 years, or whatever, that's up to the body. We're in no hurry to die, nor are we trying to live longer than necessary. We allow this body to live its lifespan because it's not self. It does not belong to us. However long this body breathes and lives is all right. It's not mine anyway. But during the time that it's alive, there's an opportunity to die before death, to die to ignorance and selfishness, to die to greed, hatred, and delusion, to let all these things die, to let them go and let them cease. So one is observing death as it's really happening, as the ending, the cessation of these things we tend to regard as ourself, but are merely mortal conditions. Human beings tend to interpret every form of greed, hatred, and delusion as a personal thing. We think, I'm greedy, I'm angry, I'm deluded, and because I am, you are. So the I am, you are conviction creates the illusion of my being a personality. But what is personality? What is self? What is it really? We can observe the fear of letting go of our personality when we notice the subtle thought, if I'm not obsessed with myself, then what's going to be left? I'll dissolve and disappear into a void. If I don't make a lot of karma for myself, have interesting neurotic problems, go to psychiatrists, spend hours talking about my fears and anxieties, make emotional attachments, what then? We can see how afraid we are of letting go of our personality. Family relationships provide a good example. If you have children, you might say, how can I not be attached to my children? Well, you don't have to throw your children into a crater to convince yourself you're not attached to them. Dying to selfishness, letting selfishness die, doesn't mean that you don't love your children. It means you're no longer attached to the perception of you as someone whose happiness is dependent on the belief that these children are yours, that they love you, that they can't live without you, and that you can't live without them. We can create a whole sticky web of delusion about children. We call it loving our children, when actually, that love is caught up in a web of attachment and ignorance. Very little love can really happen in that kind of relationship. So love doesn't mean attachment. It means being able to see clearly, to be joyous and selfless, to give freely and to serve others without selfish interests. It's being able to live without the views of me and mine, and without the kind of misery that we can create around our parents, our children, our husband, our wife, our friends, our world. Perhaps death is the awakening from the dream of life. Have you ever thought of it like that? Life lived with a self-view can be a living death, a continuous kind of misery and fear that swarms within our minds. Depression is death. Despair is death. Fear, desire, and ignorance are death. So we can live a living death, or we can die to death before we die, by awakening from the dream of life and from the illusions of a self. We have to accept the limitations of being born in a body. We have to bear with the seeming separateness that this gives us, and also with the sense of being pulled towards the objects of senses all the time. This is just part of the karma of birth. These bodies, having been born, this is the way it is. But we're not judging it, saying it's mine, or that it should be this way or that way. Instead, we're noting. This takes mindfulness, the ability to observe and be open-minded, in order to see how it really is. So this sensory world as it is, as we experience it within the lifespan of this body, is our Dhamma practice. It's always teaching us. It's always our refuge and teacher. As you can see, this way of reflection is a kind of turnabout from the worldly attitude. Death is generally considered a tragedy, something terrible and frightening. Sometimes it's considered morbid even to think about it. Yet to me it seems very important to reflect on it because it's something that's going to happen to me. The only real certainty in life is death. All these bodies will die. The death of this body is one of the important events in this life. In our meditation, we're learning how to die. We're learning how to allow things to flow according to their nature, how to be open, receptive, and in harmony with the way things are. And the way things are includes all that we experience within our lives, even the illnesses, the aging process, and death. Even if you should be in perfect health from birth to death, that does not prevent aging and death. So we investigate old age, sickness, and death, not for any morbid reason, but because these are the very processes we're involved with. It's ridiculous to think about butterflies and Persian miniatures all our life and ignore the very fundamental processes of human existence. When I'm dying, I don't imagine a butterfly is going to be much consolation or of any great import. In our monasteries, we've had the opportunity to be with several people as they were dying. What has been important for each of them was the Dhamma. It wasn't how much money they'd made, or the achievements of their worldly life, or their failures. At the time of death, all these things seem so irrelevant, so totally unimportant. But what is important is the Dhamma, the ability to reflect, to contemplate, and to meditate on the way it is. Everything is changing and moving in its own way. The changing nature of the body, the way it ages, the days, the nights, and the seasons of the year. Some things move quickly and some things move slowly. But what we're beginning to notice in meditation is this changing energy. We're cultivating awareness of change in our lives rather than just putting in time, doing things and then deluding ourselves that our personal achievements are important and urgent. If you follow that way of living, by the time you get old and are ready to die, you won't know what really happened to your life. You will have just been putting in time, waiting for death to come. The contemplative mind stays with the way things are, with the movement and change of energy. So it's no longer me waiting for death, or me just putting in time and getting through life somehow as best I can. There is mindfulness and there is investigation, which allows us to see things as they are. We are letting go of illusions and can begin to see the end of suffering. If we're not aware of what life is about, we get confused. We say, why me? Why do I have to get old? Why do I have to have arthritis? Why do I have to be in this nursing home? It's not fair. If there really were a God, he would have made it so that I could be fit as a fiddle my whole life and die in perfect health. I'd just suddenly go to sleep and not wake up. No pain, no misery, no disgusting things happening. I'd have a perfect death, and I would never feel embarrassed or be a burden. I'd always be at my cleanest, nicest, most acceptable, and most pleasing. But we know, don't we, what's going to happen. And a lot of it's not very pretty, very clean or nice. But it's Dhamma, isn't it? It's the way things are. We begin to appreciate all of the Dhamma, not just the nice side of it, because we're seeing it in perspective through the awakened mind and through wisdom, rather than through the self. The self will always be saying, oh, I don't want to be a burden on anybody. I don't want to have to lose control of my bowels. It'll be terribly embarrassing. That's self-view. It's misery, isn't it? Because life doesn't go the way you want. And even if it does go the way you want, you still worry about it. You think, what if? You know it's all right now, but anything could happen. And that's a thought that causes suffering. Life is fraught with dangers, and the self is always in danger. It's dangerous to be selfish. So actually, the death of the self is relief, nibbana. It's release from danger, from struggle and strife, and from all the suffering that we produce out of the illusion of self. We live in a world, in a society that holds to that illusion, but in Dhamma practice, we're challenging that illusion. We're not just trying to be clever and dismiss it, but are investigating, is this really the way it is? Is this the real truth? What is the truth? And we're no longer looking for someone to come along and tell us the truth, because we know that we have to realize it for ourselves. The truth is here and now, to be seen by each one of us for ourselves through the practice of mindfulness and wisdom. When people have died in our monasteries over the past years, people with terminal illnesses, the monks and nuns nursed them through their death. Since I had never done that before, the experience was a revelation to me. I actually found it quite joyful. Ordinarily, we imagine the experience of death as so negative that we think, somebody's dying, I don't want to see, I don't want to go, I'd rather go anywhere else. One woman came to die, a Thai woman, was about 43 years old, and she had terminal cancer. She was a meditator, and she was very open about what was happening to her. She took ordination as a nun when she was dying, and the nuns took care of her. The monks would also sit with her sometimes and meditate with her. Her Thai friends used to come from London to see her, and they'd ask how she was. I'd say, she's really wonderful. And they'd say, oh, is she getting well? They were surprised when I answered, no. They couldn't see how she was very beautiful and very pure in her dying state. They just felt that if she was dying, that was terrible. But when you were actually with her, you didn't feel negative. You weren't eager for her to die. You would rather she lived, so there was a kind of sadness involved, but it wasn't depressing. Then, when she actually died, the community was very uplifted by it. Even though cultural perceptions of death have negative connotations, it is actually not at all depressing or horrible when there is the ability to open to it. To be someone who is dying can even be inspiring. To be with someone who is dying can even be inspiring when you encourage that kind of openness with the dying person and within yourself towards the future. Reflecting on the future is important for us. The future is what hasn't happened yet. It's the unknown. It's the potential for what could happen, whether for good fortune or bad, for pleasure or pain. As Buddhists, we contemplate the future because we recognize that what we do in the present moment establishes the cause of what will happen to us in the future. The teaching is simple. When we do good, we receive good, and when we do bad, we receive bad. This is the law of cause and effect, or karma. If we live now in a way that is harmful, unkind, and selfish, it brings a bad result in the future. With an understanding of karma, we know that it's important now to take on the responsibility for how we live, what we do, and what we say. We know that it's important to live this life in the human form in the right way. The future. What is your perception of that? When you think about the future, what happens to your mind? Just ask yourself, what do you want to happen? What do you fear or dread, expect or hope? These are the conditions we create about the future, aren't they? Expectation, speculation, guessing, hoping, longing, dreading, fearing, anticipating. These are the mental states we create about the future because the future is unknown. We speculate a lot about the future. Some people go to clairvoyants or fortune tellers, and then they can say, maybe this will happen, or maybe that will happen. But the mode of meditation is not speculation. We are observing how things actually are, and what we recognize is that the future is unknown. It's something vast and infinitely mysterious, with the potential for anything, from the best to the worst. But often, because we know that our bodies will die and we will be separated from what we love, the future involves dread in the mind. We don't want to think about it too much because it reminds us of death and separation. Our attachment to life, as we are experiencing it, makes us frightened of death. We become so attached to our life, to the human form we are in, to the people we love, to the things we have, and to the world as we perceive it, that the whole thought of being separated from it can be very anguishing to us. So we hang desperately onto life, onto other people, onto things, onto a sense of stability and safety, only to have it all inevitably snatched away from us as time goes by. So death for us is one of the most frightening mysteries. Nowadays, people like to speculate about what happens when people die. The materialist view is that you die and that's the end. The reincarnationist's view is that our soul is reborn in a different form. Some religious views propose a celestial heaven and a subterranean hell. But what you have to admit to yourself is that you don't know what happens because you haven't died yet. The future is unknown, but you are very much involved with existence in a living form at this time. So we must come to terms with now, in this existence, this life, so within the changing mortal conditions of sensory consciousness. Rather than speculate about what will happen in the future when the body dies, the Buddha pointed to the fact that within this limitation of human consciousness, the way out of suffering is by being aware of the way things are now. This is the way out of birth in the mind. And the way out of birth is also the way out of death, because you cannot have death without birth. The Buddha's teaching is always pointing to the way out of being reborn in the present moment, even though the body is still existing, still breathing, still able to think and feel and sense and experience. With right understanding, there is no rebirth coming from ignorance. There is only the natural movement and flow of consciousness and the peace of just knowing, rather than this fear and desire that comes from ignorance. And with right understanding, there is openness and trust with which to approach the unknown future. Right view, the right way of seeing things, is a completely fearless way because it is infinite. It is eternal. It is something truly grand and miraculous. Because we can't perceive it, all we can do is open to it. Open the mind to the unknown, the mystery. This can be terrifying. The religious experience is often described as a terrible one, which means that it is terrifying. It is taking away, pulling away, everything that you identify with and depend on, everything you feel safe and comfortable with. Suddenly it's all removed, ripped away from you, and you are left with nothing. But the marvelous thing about it is that when you can accept it, that is where you find true peace. It is truly peaceful to be completely open, totally vulnerable and alert to the mystery of the unknown. In addition to speculating about the future, we often build defenses to protect ourselves against it. But by increasing our defenses, we are just increasing the amount of fear and anxiety. Yet we think that is the way to safety. We think we've got to make ourselves so strong that no one will dare attack us, but the attitude demands endless propping up, doesn't it? And our defenses inevitably fail us. We can look mean and flex our muscles a bit, but we can't stand with muscles flexed all the time. We have to relax. And when we do, somebody can catch us in a position in which we are quite vulnerable. All the defenses we can build are no protection against the unknown. One definition of the religious experience is making yourself totally vulnerable with no protection at all, not even asking God to help you, not saying, "Please help me," when somebody is attacking you, being able to be totally vulnerable and totally sensitive to the planet, the universe, the grand mystery. To me, this is the whole purpose and ultimate perfection of human life. We begin to see that the only way out of suffering is not by protecting ourselves, but by allowing ourselves to be completely open. Our society is very interested in protection against the unknown. It offers insurance, retirement benefits, and all kinds of safeties and securities that we demand and expect. And yet, the Buddhist religious life is exemplified by the monk, an alms mendicant who is totally dependent and defenseless, a little bit odd, a little bit outside of everything, who wears orange robes and has a shaven head. The conventions of a monk's life are merely external symbols representing what we need to do internally. To internalize that monk or mendicant means that you must be willing to trust in the Dhamma, in the truth. The more you practice meditation, the more you have insight into the way things actually are, and the more joy, faith, and confidence you feel. The more you practice, the more willing you are to completely open yourself to the mystery, to the vastness, to the awesomeness, without trembling. As human beings, we are vulnerable little creatures. In contrast to the universe, we are weak and soft. For example, we have very delicate skin that's easily damaged. But in spite of our vulnerability in the midst of a vast and mysterious universe, one can feel total trust. From my own insight, through meditation, I know that there is total trust now. There is complete confidence in the benevolence and wonder of the universe. One can't really perceive the whole vast universe in any clear way. One can only open to it. Ordinarily, human consciousness is limited to the perceptions we have through our senses. It's very difficult for us to catch glimpses beyond that. But the more we let go of our grasping of the sensory world, the less we hold on to it and identify with it, the more we begin to have a glimpse of deathlessness. We begin to experience Amaravati, the deathless realm, the underlying unity, the overlying compassion, the whole wondrous miracle. It's part of the human condition that, in spite of our obvious limitations as individual creatures, we have an ability to comprehend the whole. But that comprehension comes not from the perception of the whole, but from the opening of the heart. We're not just trying to believe in a perception of wholeness that we hold as a doctrine. We're going to the very experience of wholeness as we open the heart. This is fearlessness. It is the willingness to be hurt, to be totally sensitive, and to bear with the pain, despair, and confusion of our sensory experience. So the future is unknown. As spiritual seekers, we turn towards the unknown. Rather than constantly hanging on to the known in our meditation, more and more we begin to open our heart to the unknown. We relish that, we long for that. Just the simple openness of heart and the willingness to bear with life as we are experiencing it, with all its ups and downs, good fortune, bad fortune, pleasure and pain. We are no longer crying for God to protect us and help us and send us good fortune. We're no longer expecting a life that offers only good health and pleasure. We'll take whatever comes, whatever it is. This is the way we approach the future, not by looking for protection, but by opening our hearts.
kataya sadukalam tatamase
sa.